You've been in trouble all your life. Why is that?
I'm just one of those faces, you know. People never like my face.
D-Ball!
If we succeed, generations to come will say of us now living that we mastered our moment.
Everybody's talking, no one says a word. Everybody's making love.
You have to be more politically aware in a day and age like this. It's impossible to close your eyes to it.
Nobody told me there'd be need like these.
As South Vietnamese forces become stronger, the rate of American withdrawal can become greater.
Peace in your mind, peace in the world.
We're selling it like soap, peace or war, that's the two products.
There was a fear that John could imperil the political existence of Richard Nixon.
John was daring to speak out.
We came here to say to all of you, apathy isn't it, and that we can do something.
His activities were being monitored.
I was followed in a car, and my phone was tapped. I think they wanted me to know to scare me, and I was scared, paranoid.
The Immigration and Naturalization Service began deportation proceedings.
Will you stop speaking out against the war?
No, nothing will stop me. I'll always say what I feel.
Our society is run by insane people for insane objectives, so I'm liable to be put away as insane for expressing that.
Their distortion of the Constitution was the greatest disloyalty to this country.
Like me. Lenin represented life, and Mr. Nixon and Mr. Bush represent death.
A superstar.
His message is still alive.
Our job now is to tell them that there is still hope. We must get them excited about what we can do again.
The U.S. versus John Lennon.
You have it. The U.S. versus John Lennon. Now I'm going to read you something from New York Times, the arts section. John Lennon has been dead for 30 years, but the Federal Bureau of Investigation is still on the case. On Wednesday morning, a small pop culture memorabilia shop in Midtown opened an 836-lot auction timed to what would have been Lennon's 70th birthday, which is Saturday. The prized item was a set of Lennon's fingerprints made in 1976 as part of his application for citizenship. Minimum bid was supposed to be $100,000. But after an hour-long standoff involving cell phone calls, faxes, and meetings with an agent in a parked car outside of East 57th Street storefront, the FBI served the shop called Gotta Have It with a subpoena and seized the fingerprint card, which was made at a New York police station on May 8, 1976, and bears the signature of John Winston Ono Lennon. Given Lennon's history with the FBI, he was under surveillance in the early 70s for his anti-war activism. The events were strange enough to make Peter Siegel, the owner of the store, wonder what...
Thank you.
and good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, well, a major variance on my annual Halloween show. By the way, happy Samhain. We will be hearing from Richard Kadrey and, well, begging a little. Stay tuned. Oh, and of course, some requisite Halloween music.
We'll be right back.
just like whoever. So quit complaining, brother. No one lives forever. Let's have a party. There's a full moon in the sky. It's the hour of the wolf, and I don't want to die. No one beats it at his game for very long, but just the same, who cares? There's no place safe to hide, nowhere to run, no time to cry. So celebrate while you still can, because any second it may end when it's old and said and done. Better that you would have some fun instead of hiding in a shell. Why make your life a living hell? Trick or toast, down the gun.
See something strange.
Come with us and you will see. This our town of Halloween.
This is Halloween. This is Halloween.
Pumpkins scream in the dead of night.
This is Halloween. Everybody make a scene.
Trick or treat.
Tell the neighbors on your diaphragm.
It's our town.
Everybody's free.
It's town of Halloween.
I am the one hiding under your bed. Teeth ground sharp and eyes glowing red.
I am the one hiding under your stairs. Fingers like snakes and spiders in my hair.
This is Halloween, this is Halloween, 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 Halloween.
In this town we call home, everyone hail to the pumpkin song.
In this town, don't we love it now? Everybody's waiting for the next surprise.
Round that corner man, hiding in the trash can. Something's waiting there to pounce and howl. You'll scream.
This is Halloween.
Red and black.
It's slimy green.
Aren't you scared?
Well, that's just fine.
Say it once, say it twice. Take a chance and roll the dice.
Ride with the moon in the dead of night.
Everybody scream. Everybody scream.
Here I am, Halloween.
I am the clown with the tearaway face.
Here in a flash of Jonathan Trace.
I am the who in the cold who's there.
I am the wind blowing through your hair.
I am the shadow on the moon at night, filling your dreams to the brim with fright.
This is Halloween, this is Halloween. Halloween, 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 Halloween,
Halloween, Halloween, Halloween.
Tiddlywinks everywhere. Life's no fun without a good scare.
That's our job.
But we're not mean
in our town of Halloween.
In this town,
don't we love it now?
Everyone's waiting for the next surprise.
Skeleton Jack might catch you in the back and
scream like a bat. You make you jump out of your skin.
This is Halloween. Everybody scream.
Won't you please make way for a very special guy?
Woman Jack is king of the pumpkin patch. Everyone hail to the pumpkin king. Now this is Halloween.
And so we howl. You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. This is Hour of the Wolf, brought to you over these same airwaves since 1972. And my name is Jim Freund. And we have a tradition here on Hour of the Wolf of doing a Samhain program. It may be a Halloween program. It might be a Samhain program. It's whenever my show is closest to the holiday. And I think it's fair to say that with the today being October 30th, that it's Halloween weekend. It has begun. Everybody but WBAI, it seems, is doing specific Halloween programming. I mean, of course, you can count on specific shows like the Golden Age of Radio and all that on doing appropriate things. But on Hour of the Wolf, we try. However, it is a pitching morning, a begging morning. It was originally scheduled that I was not going to be on this week. They were alternating the overnights with recorded programs, such as the one you just heard on Lennon with Peter Boshan, and as Max puts it, as the Earl Caldwell special, okay, festival. And anyway, when I took a look at the schedule, saw that I was going to be on the 23rd, which I was not prepared to do because I was planning to be at a science fiction convention in Washington, D.C., where, in fact, I was. And not to be on for my Halloween show, I asked our program director, and with no problems whatsoever, he said, yeah, go ahead. We'll switch those dates. So I am here this week, but it is nevertheless still a pitching morning. Now, last time I was on, I played you an interview by Sherry Tepper, and we had autographed books. And the response was okay, but it was not great. And we need to make it great this time, or else they'll give me less and less opportunities to be on the air during fundraising drives. And if they give me the opportunities to be on the air during those fundraising drives, I won't be able to play programs or readings or music or anything. I'll just be begging for money for the 2 hours. This is not what we want. And besides, as anybody knows, especially during All Hallows, you cannot get blood from a turnip. So, we need to do well this morning. And I have for you 5 premiums by one of the best horror writers, perhaps comic horror, if you know, very tongue-in-cheek when you step back. And his name is Richard Kadrey, K-A-D-R-E-Y. And he has a brand new book out called Kill the Dead. It is the second book that features his character Sandman Slim, which is, by the way, optioned at more than optioned. I think it's actually approaching treatment and therefore perhaps production. But Dino De Laurentiis has had it for a while and is actually developing it at this point. And, well, you'll hear about it because I recorded an interview with Richard when he was in town for the New York Comic Convention. And he was very giving of his time, which was, I must say, real tight. They were moving him from one place to another, this meeting, that meeting, this interview. But we got him here and are very pleased. Unfortunately, my almost disaster happened to the interview. I was unable to edit the sucker. It had been recorded here, and it was fine. I listened to it here and then, you know, put it onto my drive, my portable drive, to take it home to work with it. And this morning, you know, a scant few hours ago, as I was getting ready to edit it and bring it here, it doesn't need lots of editing, but, you know, tightening up and all that, and it wouldn't play. It just wouldn't play on my machine. In fact, when I tried it on 2 computers that I currently have. So that was a problem. And by the way, Richard did a lovely thing. He recorded a short story here, but he was saying, oh, you know, now I think of it, there's a better short story I could read. And he recorded it in San Francisco, where he lives. and I have that as well, and that plays fine. But I was able to get here, and with the magic of Max Schmid, which is very magical, very giving of his time and helpful, we were able to convert this to a broadcastable format about half an hour ago. This is unedited sound. So I'm going to be listening to it with my finger on the little button where somebody says, bleep, can we do that again? It's one of the reasons I really prefer live interviews. So we're going to hear not all, but much of the interview with Richard Kadrey. Let me just see how long here is part one. Because it would be nice. Ooh, that alone is 50 minutes. And you know what? We are going to play all of part one. Don't know if we're going to get, and certainly the reading. But how much we get to hear of part three? Part two will be the reading, and I'm going to substitute the one that Richard recorded and emailed to me. How much, if we can hear any of part three, or any more Halloween music and the usual fun stuff that we do on the Samhain every year, well, that's all up to you. It's all up to getting pledges, okay? And by the way, I'm really, it's been 3 weeks since I've been on the air. Missed two shows in a row. One for the fun drive, one for being away, and they swapped this would be the fun and all that, right? So, gotta do well, right, gang? Okay. So I'll tell you exactly what we've got as a premium. First of all, if you just want to call up and become a member of WBAI, being a member is $25 pledge. You want a copy? If you pledge $75, we will say thank you by sending you a copy of the new Sandman Slim book, Kill the Dead, which is a lot of fun, and you're going to be hearing a bit about it in just a moment. But A, it's autographed. I think they're even autographed saying, you know, thanks for subscribing to WBAI. And B, we only have five. You want one? Call early. I think they will go. I can't imagine why they wouldn't go. Okay? So, 212-209-2950. Be one of the, get in ahead of other people by calling now. Just take my word for it. You'll want to do this. 212-209-2950. And make a pledge, become a member of WBAI, support Hour of the Wolf, and support WBAI, and get yourself an autographed copy, eBay worthy. It's a collector's item of Richard Kadrey's latest novel. 212-209-2950. Now, before I get to that interview, I've got that. Let's go all the way over here. Get my bag. I have announcements. I have to find the stuff on Making Waves. 22 fabulous Broadway stars want to offend you for a good cause. It will cost you $35. And Hal Linden. I haven't even read this yet, so I'm going to do it later. But basically, there's a benefit honoring the 50th anniversary of BAI on Monday, November 8th at 7:30 p.m. And actually, for a benefit of this type, the tickets are very inexpensive. They are $35. And to know more about this, go to wbai.org/makingwaves, okay? And I'm going to read this through, and I'll give you more information again a little bit later. Apparently, I am supposed to be appearing on stage for this thing. We shall see. But before that Monday rolls around, this Tuesday rolls around, and we had, at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, we had a fabulous event last Tuesday, Beyond Blackula. Terrence Taylor put together himself, L.A. Banks, Leslie Banks, Aliyah Johnson, and Linda Addison for what was just a wonderful reading of black writers who write vampire books. You know, it's not a segment on, you know, the Dr. Phil show or something like that. This was something that we did, and it was very cool. But it was an extracurricular event. Our normal, if you want to call it that, our regular event is this coming Tuesday. Yes, I have been busy from a convention to the Beyond Blackula event this Tuesday. And what I was going to have has been moved to May. So at the science fiction convention that I was attending, I walked up to the Hugo Award-winning Neil Clark, who puts out Clark's World magazine, and said, "Get me some readers and show up." And he done it. So, the name of the event is, I have to take a deep breath here, Clark's World's 50th issue, and oh my God, did we really win the Hugo Award, Election Day celebration for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings at the Soho Gallery of Digital Art. That's the name. Reading will be Desirina Boscovich and Genevieve Valentine, hosted by Neil Clark. Desirina Boscovich is a graduate of the Clarion Class of 2007. As a freelance writer, she specializes in weird, fantastic, and unlikely things, both true and imaginary. Her work has appeared in Clark's World magazine, Realms of Fantasy, Last Drink, Birdhead, Fantasy magazine, and Lightspeed magazine, and is forthcoming in The Way of the Wizard. She is also working on a novel. And then Genevieve Valentine, who's been on this show several times, World Fantasy Award nominated short fiction, has appeared in or is forthcoming from Running with the Pack, The Living Dead 2, The Way of the Wizard, Teeth, Clark's World, Strange Horizons, and more. Her first novel, Mechanique, is forthcoming from Prime Books in 2011. Her appetite for bad movies is insatiable, and a tragedy she tracks on her blog at GenevieveValentine.com. I'm not going to spell it all out for you, but suffice it to say, it's going to be a really fun evening. I don't think we're going to be overly crowded this time, being, you know, people will just be coming back from the World Fantasy Convention and it's Election Day and all that, but you can be there. We hold the readings at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, which is it's on Sullivan Street between Prince and Houston. And for more information, go to ourwolf.com and look for the link on the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, or NYRSF, NYRSF Readings, and all the information is right there. Or follow my Twitter feed. I have it on there. Or look it up on Facebook. It's in all of those places. Okay? Well, now that we are already running shy of time, and we haven't moved one book. Come on, guys. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. Originally, by the way, talking with the program director and powers that be here, the typical thank you amount, we can't say like we're selling the book, it's a thank you gift for subscribing, right? The original amount would have been something like $150. And we all agreed that we're going to make these move. So that's why it's a $75 pledge. Okay? Yes, usually you can say, I was about to say, yes, I know you can buy the book much cheaper, but these are autographed. So, yes, you could buy it much cheaper. Now all you've got to do is find Richard Cadry, who lives on the West Coast, and get him to do it. Or you can give a tax-deductible donation to WBAI, become a member of WBAI, show support for Hour of the Wolf, and get an autographed copy, a collector's item, of Kill the Dead. Okay, it is time to listen to that interview with Richard Cadry. And, you know, we got to play Tam Lin and Maddie Groves and all that stuff. and we're not going to have the time. So whether or not we have the time, well, it's up to you to call. 212-209-2950. Make the call now. 212-209-2950. I am not a recording. I am not telling you about this person or that person and how they and how their life has been improved by some semi-magical means. Rather, I am telling you that we have, well, a mission here and a program that is intended to entertain, that has been on these airwaves since 1972 and follows a tradition that precedes me of great science fiction and fantasy. People who've worked here have included Samuel R. Delaney, Joanna Russ, Theodore Sturgeon, Thomas M. Dish. If they weren't on staff, they were at least part of like Baird Searles' stable or stuff like that. And this is a tradition we want to keep going. And it is unique in this country. There are some other science fiction shows, but none that have the history, the breadth, the depth that we at WBAI have brought you. And the other show that came as close and was a wonderful show, Hour 25, was at KPFK, was at our sister station in Los Angeles, done by Mike Odell, who was here first, who appeared on Hour of the Wolf fairly regularly in its earliest days when Margot Adler was still the host. So, 212-209-2950. Call and pledge, and now we will listen to an interview recorded very early this month here at WBAI with Richard Kadrey. And I would say we were rolling if it wasn't for the fact that everything is digital.
And you I miss things rolling. I miss analog tape.
I really do, yeah. It's much more fun. But I will slate it, and they stopped using slates, I don't know how many years ago, by saying it's 2:45 on 10-9-10. No, 10-8-10. Ah. Today is 10-8-10. 10-10-10. Is coming in a couple of days for what that's worth. And I am at WBAI's studios, such as they are, with Richard Kadrey, who actually we did meet. I should have said this off the air. We did meet about 12 or 13 years ago. You did a reading for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which I've been recording since their inception and which I now run.
Ah, okay. Okay.
But you did do a reading for us. I got that tape somewhere.
I have no idea what I would have read at that point.
I'll have to find it.
Yeah, that'll be interesting.
When I do, I'll digitize it and send you a copy.
That'd be great.
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad I remember now because I did digitize it. Getting back, Richard Kadrey is... Okay, let me, listeners know by now, when I interview other people, I always talk about me. I don't read lots and lots of horror. I'm not a fan of dismemberment. I'm not a fan of things that go gore in the night and give me nightmares and stuff. I'm a fan of imagination. I am a fan of sense of wonder, of good ideas, of comedy. I'm also a huge fan of good pulpy type fiction of Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, etc., etc.
Mickey Spillane is a lot of the reference in my work.
Yeah, I really enjoy that. I enjoy the Spillane. I enjoy the
real pulp of someone like Spillane versus the more polished Chandler and Hammett end of things.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, because you're not aiming for the people who thought that they were putting out good writing, because Chandler had his nose in the air. He thought he was writing the great American novel.
Yeah.
And with A Long Goodbye, maybe he did. But
I wouldn't argue that's a contender, man.
Yeah, but that's not really what pulp detectives are about.
Right, right.
Pulp detectives are grimy, and so are their writers, so are their authors.
See, that's the thing for me about Spillane isn't just the books and the writing. I think he has amazing philosophy of writing. I mean, he has the least BS of any writer I can think of. You know, I mean, this is a guy talking about writing who said, "I don't have fans, I have customers." You know, and that just cuts through so much of the crap we're taught as writers, you know, that like we're not all James Joyce, and that in the end, I mean, again, Spillane, I'm not an author, I'm a writer. That's all I am.
Mm-hmm.
That's a philosophy I can go with.
Yeah, yeah, and I like both.
I like both ends of things, absolutely.
I mean, got no problem, but as the craft person, as the one who is doing the writing, who's doing the work, you can't necessarily easily be both at the same time. That's the kind of thing that Chandler tried to do.
Yeah, and sitting around thinking, am I going to write Ulysses, is the thing that will drive you insane. You just try to write the thing as well as humanly possible.
Yeah.
And I mean, when I say, you know, I'm a fan of Spillane and I like the philosophy of I'm just a writer, that doesn't mean I don't take everything I do seriously. I take it very seriously, but I know what it is, that I'm not going to win the Nobel Prize. I am here to entertain.
And that would explain why, between Sandman Slim and Kill the Dead, there were a few years.
That was one year. That was
only 1 year.
This is the Sandman Slim series is one. All the books are 1 year apart. So Aloha from Hell will be 1 year from now. That's the third book.
Okay. Now, what was I thinking of? That there was.
Well, there was Butcher Bird. Was the one. There was a few years between that and Sandman Slim.
This is what I do by saying, "Oh, I know this stuff. I don't have to have notes in front of me."
Yeah.
Sigh. Okay. So.
Yeah.
Let us talk a little bit. Which do you want to talk about first?
You ask the questions. I'll roll with whatever.
Okay. Why don't we start with what? Why don't we start at the very beginning? A very good place to start. We were talking about musicals off air. Antecedents. What were you reading? What compelled you to write what you write?
You want to start like when I was a kid?
Yeah.
I mean, I was one of those kids. I was one of those kids who grew up watching every horror movie, reading whatever science fiction horror I could find. And that was literally from the classy stuff like Poe that my mother gave me and my uncles and, used bookstores. I'm from Brooklyn, so there were lots of used bookstores with old, like, 50s
what
and 40s pulp magazines. Park Slope.
Ah, okay.
Back when Park Slope was not Park Slope.
Yeah, but I know where all the used bookstores were at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm in Bay Ridge now, not one used bookstore.
Okay, yeah, that's the world these days.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was, for me, I was like a lot of kids, and then it was purely indiscriminate. My mother would take me to Shakespeare, and then I'd read an old Van Vogt story, and then I'd go watch Creature from the Black Lagoon, and it was just all the same thing to me. I mean, Midsummer Night's Dream was all the same stuff, and I grew up really in that imaginative world rather than, you know, the social realist kind of writing. And I've always, you know, I've always appreciated some of that kind of writing. But for me, there's always been this disconnect between, you know, the hardcore trying to depict everyday life with all its, you know, problems and everything, John Updike, you know, Rabbit Run stuff. It's like I don't care about that in terms of fiction. When I want to see that, I'm obsessed with documentaries, you know, so I'll go look at the Loud family, you know. In terms of fiction, I want to see something beyond that. I really enjoy the imagination more than I enjoy stark realism, because realism is there already. I'll read the New York Times. That's realism. You know, I want to see something beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's ever since I was a kid. It's just that natural thing. It's like I never forced myself into any of that. I mean, I just felt very comfortable in that kind of world. And some of it's a little darker than others. You know, you when I discovered Clive Barker later and Hellraiser and all that, it's like, yeah, I could live there.
Oh, you know? Dear.
And, you know, I've always objected to the word dark. People, I use it to explain stuff because that's what everybody uses. But it's always annoyed me, like, you know, he writes dark fantasy, dark fiction. And it's like, no, I don't write dark stuff. I write
Well, actually,
that's my realism. It's like I write what I see, you know, with the old, you know, write what you know thing. And it's like that's kind of where my brain is. And there's nothing dark about it to me. That is the normal way of the world. Yes. And I mean, get chaotic place.
Yeah. What would be an easier way to describe? I mean, certainly I produced a reading that we almost had you at this last Tuesday, where Shannon McGuire was reading.
Right.
And, you know, how everybody stood there and listened to her. And while she read a comedy story, everybody went, man, that is dark.
Yeah.
And I hear what you're saying, and I understand, but I, being a radio person or whatever, I'm at a loss for words. What's the phrase? What's the word? How do you say that this thing is not from that little giggly place? Well, actually, it is from that little giggly place, isn't
it?
But, you know, that it's not Laurel and Hardy.
Right, right. Yeah, it's hard, you know. I mean, chaos is the word I come back to a lot.
It's a good one.
Yeah.
It's a very good one.
You know, because also the Sandman Slim books, for instance, there is a lot of chaos even in the background of the characters. I mean, you read a lot of the fiction with magical people. It's almost like the three laws of robotics. You have these very rigid laws of how magic works, who does magic, things like that. Whereas in the Sandman Slim books, it is completely chaotic because Stark, the character who is called Sandman Slim, doesn't have a system. He grew up as a kid being very powerful from birth, but he was disconnected completely from other magic people. So he just made it up as he went along. Mm-hmm. He's like that, actually, there's probably something about that me, and that I'm completely self-educated. So like he sort of went off on his own, figured it out on his own, and then later he was thrown into hell. And so again, there, he didn't learn anything formally, but he was thrown into essentially the arena in hell where he had to fight and he had to learn magic there. So again, it's not systematic for him. It was what's useful at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no overall magical structure for his point of view. So again, you have a chaotic thing where I very clearly didn't want to have Stark rules of Stark, not to be cute about it, but I did not want hardcore rules. I wanted, even in that core character, his own magic to come completely out of just something he would just pull out of the back of his brain.
Mm-hmm.
And also to mix that with, I mean, I'm very conscious that this is an American fantasy, him being completely willing to shoot someone in the back, you know, as well as use magic. He likes his guns, and he is perfectly happy to, he will alternate that, whatever seems appropriate for the moment. If he loses his temper, he's perfectly happy to shoot you.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what's his full name?
You're going to kill me here. James
Stark.
James Butler Hickok Stark.
Okay. Let's go through the etymology of each.
Which is, you take those bits in the middle, and basically you're into Wild Bill Hickok.
Right.
And, you know, the mythology around someone like that, and Stark himself is very much in that kind of the gunfighter, but also, you know, the Hickok story of like being, you go too far with that, you live too long with that life, and you're gonna crash and burn. And is he gonna get there or not is one of the big questions. Is he gonna go as far as ending up with an aces and eights kind of checkout at some point? And, you know, that question is really important to me, like how far someone like this can go. And also, you know, there's something about the fact that I'm trying to bring a very 70s spaghetti Western American crime fiction, American movies, you know, Peckinpah, Leone, people like that. I'm trying to put that in the books without actually saying it out loud, just to
Well, the pulp detective is not so much 70s. We are spaghetti Western,
right?
In the 70s, your detectives are also not really.
Well, he's not a detective. I mean, I really, really want to emphasize that this book Stark comes out of American crime fiction,
right,
not American mysteries. This is a guy who comes from, was inspired by Richard Stark, one of Donald Westlake's pseudonyms, Jim Thompson, people like that, where you look at criminals doing their crimes.
They are 70s. They are 70s.
Very much.
I was thinking Mickey Spillane 50s, but no, Jim Thompson and Westlake, those are 70s.
Yeah, 60s, very 70s. Much, you know, The Killer Inside Me, The Getaway is very much in that, you know, both the book and the movie are very much the kind of sensibility I'm going for. The you know, there's inspiration.
Also the humor, because Westlake is always funny.
Westlake, yeah.
Westlake is always writing comedy, no matter how
Stark, the Richard,
chaotic.
The Parker books by Richard Stark are some of his most stripped-down stuff and the least comic stuff he's going to do. And that's one of the reasons I was interested in that can you do something that terse and hard as those Parker books? Parker is a series he did about a thief.
Not to be confused with Robert Parker.
Right? Exactly, exactly. So Parker was the thief's name. And could you do something that hard? And that's really where this came from. And my take on it was to layer the comedy on top of it simply because I knew how hard and violent and relentless this character Stark was going to be, and I knew that you just couldn't take it beyond a certain point. You know, this guy's fury and the violence he was heading toward, it would just be too much if he didn't have that gallows humor. And you know, and then meeting cops and EMTs, all the people with the worst, most violent jobs always have a real sense of humor about it. You know, you don't necessarily want to hear the humor if you're not in their world, but it's there. They have the back to the word dark, the darkest, meanest, most brutal senses of humor, but it's still funny. It just happens to be a joke about some guy whose head's blown off.
Yeah. It used to be, due to the political world in which we live, and by necessity, I'm sure my colleagues here at Pacifica Radio will point out, it used to be what we called black comedy.
Right.
And, you know, that's not necessarily what then was Godfrey Cambridge or something.
Right, right.
Although Godfrey Cambridge didn't...
He had his dark moments.
He certainly did. And I think he was even in a Westlake movie or three.
He wasn't in the Hot Rock.
No, he wasn't, but was he...
What's the bank movie? The one with the George C. Scott one. Was he in that one?
I think he was. Yeah. Should have been if he wasn't.
Yeah, I don't know the Westlake movies that well. I mean, I definitely remember
some
the
of them
Hot
are
Rock.
Some of them are not bad.
Hot Rock I really
enjoyed. And God knows under what pseudonym.
Right.
You know, it's only, I think, after Westlake's death that we found out that he didn't have 10 pseudonyms. He had 20.
Yeah, yeah. See, that's another thing I respect about those guys, the guys who had real output. I mean, there's something I'm trying to learn to write faster.
And they didn't hack.
And they didn't. That's the thing.
That's the
quality,
amazing thing.
Doing quality and learning to put that out. And
still
I'm trying
craft.
To learn that.
It was still craft for them.
Exactly.
It was amazing.
I don't know if I'll get there. You know, I have to admit that. I don't know if I'll get there. But it's another skill I'm trying to learn as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always trying to go to the next thing, learn the next thing. I've learned a certain amount of craft that let me do my last few books and do them the way I do. I mean, my books, I always have an outline that I work with, and I know a certain amount of material within the books, but I always leave holes, plot holes, character holes, mystery holes, because if I try and fill in every single thing from the beginning, it's going to be, it's that front brain stuff where it's very mechanical. So I leave holes because that's when your unconscious is going to fill some of those holes with something you never thought of. You know, a lot of the odd connections in the book come from me just saying, I don't know, I'm going to leave that out there and something's going to show up. And having that kind of trust in yourself that something will show up and it's nothing you would have planned consciously. It just comes out of nowhere, and then you see, yes.
You know why I think that's dangerous?
That's what I'm going for.
I think that's dangerous because you're leaving room. If you don't fill that hole, fanfic. It's going to be...
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. But that's one of those things that you learn to trust about yourself after you've written long enough. I mean, I know it will appear. And I really
Good.
Like that in my books, is that something I would never have planned myself appears. I have a character in the book that's not published yet, Aloha from Hell, the third Sandman Slim book, who I didn't plan, but I realized was someone very different than he appears to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not something I planned, but made absolute sense to me when,
it
you know,
appeared.
The back of my brain went, no, really, this is what you're getting at. You didn't know that.
Okay.
But this is what you're getting at.
We have made enough references by now and all that, and we've been jumping back and forth through time, that we finally have to tell people, who's Sandman Slim?
Sandman Slim is Stark, who is... In fact, let me back up just a little bit. My character's name is James Stark, and I wanted that specifically because Richard Stark, those novels, inspired me to think of this. So I really wanted to give credit to where this stuff came from. So
enough people don't do that.
Yeah, it's like, again, I'm not trying to hide any of that stuff. I was inspired by other fiction to write this fiction. And I'm, again, not pretending that, you know, again, like, I'm not Joyce. This came out of all those pulp things that influenced me. So specifically in Sandman Slim, the first book, there is a character named Stark, and in fact there's a villain named Parker. So if you know those books at all, you're going to put those two things together, and some people have. So James Stark is a magician. He's a very powerful, another word for him would be wizard, but he refuses to use the word wizard because, as he says, that's a little too Harry Potter. So he calls himself a magician. A lot of his friends call themselves magicians. He was born with immense magical powers as a child, had no idea what they were or why, and it kind of messed him up in terms of realizing he was very different and he had to hide this stuff from the world. And it screwed up his relationships, especially with his family, less so with his mother. It became a very, very bad relationship with his father. So as he grew up, he became more aware that who he was. That he was a powerful, magical person, and then discovered this whole other world called the Sub Rosa, which was the world of all the magical people, the kind of controlling secret cabal of people who have a lot of power in California. So they're kind of, they don't run California, but they have an enormous amount of influence over politicians, cops, military, things like that. So he finds himself kind of thrown in with them, being kind of a loner and a jerk. He then walks away from them too, so he's just kind of this guy floating around with a lot of power. He's part of a magic circle, and there's another character in there called Mason Fame.
Right.
And the two of them are kind of the most powerful people, again, a little disconnected from the Sub Rosa, and they have this, it's not quite a sibling rivalry, it's a little more brutal than that. Mason wanting ultimate power and to finally kick Stark in the ass, sells Stark out to hell. And in one of their magic sessions, Stark is literally dragged down into hell, where he spends the next 11 years as a live human being in hell and becomes like a real freak show item because they've never had a living person down there before. And he's, again, a freak show. He's exhibited. He's abused in every way you can think of.
It was pure hell.
It was pure hell. But in the way that everything becomes banal over time, even him down there, they get tired of him. You know, he becomes an attraction for a while. He's the Fiji mermaid, but you get tired of the Fiji mermaid after a while. And what's the next thing? What's the next thing we can do to keep him fun? They throw him into this sort of gladiatorial world. He gets thrown into the arena where they expect him to die immediately, and he doesn't. He, in fact, discovers he has a real talent for killing things, and in fact, the other thing that's even odder is all of his injuries make him stronger. So the more he fights, the worse that happens to him actually adds to his powers over time. He then becomes Sandman Slim years later when he is, he's not hired, he's just sort of put into the service of one of the high, powerful Hellions named Azazel. He's owned by them, essentially as a slave owner, who kind of sees the power in someone like Stark. And because he's not part of the Hell community, gives him a little in to sort of turn him into Azazel's hitman. After that, Stark then becomes more powerful because he has Azazel gives him this thing called the Key, which gives him the key to what's called the Room of 13 Doors. And in the Room of 13 Doors, you can get anywhere into the universe. So he can walk into any general's house, any Hellion's house, kill them, get out, no one knows. Stark spends 11 years in Hell fighting in the arena and as a hitman. And he stays there for those 11 years with the Room of 13 Doors. Of course, he could leave at any time back to Earth. He doesn't because he is assured as long as he stays there, as long as he's a good boy, his girlfriend back on Earth will be safe. And then one day, she's murdered. And that at that point, he kills Azazel, he kills everybody who's in charge of him, crawls back to Earth, and then starts killing everyone associated with the magic circle. It's a pure revenge story. The first one is very much, again, that sort of 70s, even a samurai kind of movie of, right. You know, the injured man going back to set things right with the people who destroyed his life, destroyed his girlfriend's life. And, you know, along the way, of course, it's a purely selfish desire he has. And of course, along the way, because of the people he meets, because of the power structure he gets sucked into, he ends up in a much larger story than he ever intended to. So in the way these things work, he ends up reluctantly, very reluctantly, helping to save the world. Because really what he would like to do in his heart of heart is kill everybody who's pissed him off and then let the world die. That's optimum. You know, that's outcome for someone like him.
That's his mood, yeah.
That's his mood, but it doesn't quite work out that way. So he ends up forced to take a larger view than his own desire for revenge.
Mm-hmm.
He's forced into that. And then, you know, the rest of the series is him struggling with that pure nihilism and desire to see the world die with now having people he's connected to that he doesn't necessarily know if he wants to destroy them, destroy his girlfriend's dead, but he knows she lives on somewhere, whether it's heaven or whatever. If he burns the world, what will happen to her, wherever she is? So it's those kind of questions. He doesn't soften up, but he has to think about more what he's doing and why he's doing it.
Where does the name Sandman Slim?
Oh, I'm sorry. It becomes basically it's that kind of the boogeyman kind of a name. It's just the thing. There is a murderer in Hell. No one knows who he is. And that's the moniker he gets stuck with.
Okay.
Basically, Sandman Slim, you know, he is not fat, so he is slim. And the Sandman, again, it's an old, like, you see it in old 30s and 40s pulps, is a hitman. Mm-hmm. They call him the Sandman.
Yeah, you see that every so often.
Yeah, and that's all it is. I'm surprised I get people asking me that a lot. You know, like, where does that come from?
You know where I get confused? Because for me, the Sandman was the character out of the opera Hansel and Gretel. And, you know, being brought up in a German
right.
Folktale tradition.
Right.
With
that makes sense.
German Jewish parents. You know, mm-hmm. the Sandman has a much more grim, that's two M's, grim
yes.
kind of history.
Yes.
You know, and not Neil Gaiman-ish, not...
Right.
None of those. So for me, the Sandman is a mysterious, benign...
Right.
Thoroughly benign character who will see you safely to sleep. I think that ironically, somewhere, and I don't know where, became see you to sleep.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes,
absolutely.
Not...
It was that ironic take on that very benign character. But, you know, you dig deep enough into those benign characters and you almost always find the next layer. You find the thought, the story where this came from. You find the unbenign part of the mythology. I mean, you know, I deal with some of that because Lucifer becomes a main character during the series of the books. And one of the things that interested me in getting into that stuff were reading about a lot of early Christianity and seeing the multiple roles that Lucifer has played over time. I mean, is before the kind of banality of, you know, the fiend that you have to be worried about in the church, he had a much more complex role, and you don't even have to look for it very hard. I mean, it's right there.
It's right there.
It's right there in the book of Job. He is, with God's help, he is the man who tests the faithful. It's right there. He's not this ravenous beast who lives in the forest. His job within heaven is he is the testor. Mm-hmm. He is the person who tests the faith of the faithful.
Is this John Milton's Lucifer?
This is the Bible, man. This is the book of Job.
I know, but when Milton does Paradise
Milton is the first half of Paradise Lost is interesting. The second half becomes that kind of... he is trapped into the banality of, oh, Lucifer is just the selfish guy who wants to, you know, throw over
God's throne. I always thought
God's
the publisher
throne.
Said, but you didn't say that, the one true God.
Yeah, no, the first half, he is that kind of powerful, almost heroic person, which actually I used very much in Butcher Bird. You know,
yeah.
Lucifer is an important character in that, and it's more that front-end version of Paradise Lost, which is something that influenced me, and almost no one's actually read. But when you really get into, you know, when you think about the Lucifer in the book of Job, so much other stuff changes. The Eden story is completely different if you see his role as the tester.
Yes.
It's simply the first time he's done that. You know, it's not the snake tempting, well, he is the snake tempting them, but it's not just the monster trying to destroy the world.
No, not at all.
He is the tester of, okay, you've created these humans, you've given them certain rules, can they live up to it? And no. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the bad version of the story. If you look at the book of Job, that's actually the happy ending, you know, where Job is tested and Job passes.
Yeah.
So... if you see him in light of the role of, with God's blessing, doing horrible things to human, it's a very different take on what we've been told. What I was brought up with.
I was just thinking.
What I was brought up. I mean, you come from a Jewish tradition. I was from a very simple Protestant tradition where fear of the devil is what drives you. You know, you don't have to love God. You just have to be afraid of the devil.
But you, yeah, exactly, because you have the tester in the Jewish tradition. You have Abraham,
right.
You know, told to sacrifice his own son. But it is God who does his own testing. You know, he should delegate a little bit more, maybe. But
well, that's what the stories change. I mean, that's the other thing when you get into those early stories and you get into the heretical texts. My favorite one, I forget which tradition gets into this, Jesus and Lucifer are twin brothers who go their separate ways. And but they both come from the same place. They have the same roots, and they just have different ways of expressing the how they relate to humanity. So, I mean, again, very, very different tradition than what I was brought up in, what most people were brought up in. You discover, really, in all myths, if you go back far enough, there is not one single myth. They're all contradictory. whether it's the Greek myths or
and that is, even when you get to the hard science fiction and fantasy and stuff, that is largely what a lot of it is all about. There are, you know, the highbrow SF critics who mm-hmm. say that science fiction is mythology of the future.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have too much in the way of mythology today outside of cults and things like that. Right. What we have are Star Wars. What we have are Joseph Campbell explained. the Joseph Campbell-like excuses.
The hero's journey thing. Yeah.
Exactly. All that. The hero's journey, the troika, whether it's, you know, the old Paris, Achilles, and Helen versus Spock, Kirk, and McCoy, you know.
Yeah. And that can be helpful. It can also kick you in the ass. I was writing a book years ago called Kamikaze L'Amour, my second novel. And halfway through the book, I realized, I'm writing Orpheus. Damn it. And that can help you in that, okay, I'm dealing in a tradition that works.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it's like, oh, crap, I'm writing a myth. You know, it's like there's like this thing to live up to at that point, and you just have to sort of get over it.
Yeah,
there's
a certain point. There is a little when Catherine Valenti writes her stuff, she takes every myth in the world, puts it into a blender, and it comes out Cat Valenti.
Right.
Tolkien, of course, was drawing from Norse and Teutonic and the various different, many of them forgotten, but then again, he had Oxford to draw upon.
Right.
In order to do that. Susanna Clarke drew upon classical magic books and things like that. But it's all this, I think almost everybody who's writing any kind of fantastic literature is drawing from mythology.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And and of course, my answer to that is yes.
Yes.
So?
And also,
it read well, didn't it?
It worked.
It had meaning.
It worked.
It's more than a modernization.
Yeah.
It really is. It's more, because the wonderful thing about myths, folk tales, is the spin that everybody puts on it. It's the same thing with folk music. This song may be X many hundred years old. And then collected into a child ballad. But when somebody adds the electric guitar to it, or this or that, there comes something new. Even when the character lives instead of dies or whatever, there is as
what's the great the D.H. Lawrence story, the man who lived, there's a different take on the crucifixion.
Absolutely, absolutely. So. And sometimes when things are mired, and here's the difference, some of these people, I was forced in school to read a separate piece by John Knowles, which as a Jewish lad in Queens had no significance for me whatsoever. And when I was angrily told by the teacher, but we're talking here about, you know, Judas and Jesus, it's like, yeah.
And
who are they?
Right.
You know, what is your, you know, please, what is your point? I was, of course, failed. But this is an assumption.
The assumption there that this particular
lowercase a assumption. Yeah.
That this applies to everybody, even without any background. And I don't have to give you any background information because you know what this is.
You know it. And here's the problem. This is why a separate piece is not a good book, because it had no meaning for me without knowing that.
Right.
Now, I've read a lot of other Christian myth. I've read a lot of stuff that I can thoroughly enjoy, thoroughly partake of, and get the message of. One writer who did that for me to a large extent, I didn't understand Christian myth, didn't stop me from enjoying the Narnia books.
Right. Yeah, you don't. That's the thing. You don't need, in a book, in some of those books, you don't need to know the underpinnings. It changes the text. It brings it to a different level. But you don't need to know all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're going to take a break from that interview recorded earlier this month with Richard Kadrey to remind you that this is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. Oh, did I say listener-sponsored? Ah, well, yeah. Listener-sponsored in theory. Listener-sponsored if, well, you're one of the sponsors. But we haven't gotten any calls this morning. You see, it's a fun drive. It's not just an Hour of the Wolf show. It's not even, unfortunately, so much the annual Samhain, a.k.a. Halloween, a.k.a. All Hallows Eve, etc. program. It is a fundraising drive in which we can play some material. And for this to work, for this to happen, we need your phone calls. We need your pledges. And we need them. Well, we needed them before I started this recording. But we'll take them now. And we're going to interrupt for a little while in order to be able to get some calls in. Now, let me tell you, what you're listening to is an interview with one of the top writers of horror, Richard Kadrey, K-A-D-R-E-Y, very personable, wonderful, wonderful writer. As I said in the interview, I don't read a lot of horror, and yet his stuff, Metrophage, wasn't really horror, was actually pure science fiction. Some people would say one of the classics of cyberpunk. But his current stuff, The Sandman Slim, some might compare it, and only because it made TV, to the to Jim Butcher's novels, and why am I blanking on the name of the TV series? The Dresden Files, that's it. The lead character, Harry Dresden, out of Chicago, a wizard with a hockey stick. A lot of fun. And these books are a lot of fun. The whole premise of basically the hitman from hell hitting, well, other demons and things like that. It's really clever and fun, written in the Mickey Spillane tradition. Simon came in here and said, you know, it is time to revive the word hack in a positive way, talking about folk like Mickey Spillane. And while Richard Kadrey is not a hack per se, these books are, in the best way, hack work, you know, books that go somewhere, as Simon pointed out. The word hack means to go somewhere, which I didn't quite realize. That's very cool. And where we're going, what we have to do is to raise money this morning. Why do I then continue talking about Richard Kadrey? Because he and his publisher have given of themselves, one, the company, the other, his time and his autographs, to make 5 copies of his latest Sandman Slim novel available to you in thanks for your pledge to WBAI. And this is an exclusive for Hour of the Wolf, and there's only 5 copies. A $75 pledge to WBAI will get you one of these collectible autographed copies of Kill the Dead by Richard Kadrey. And I know, as of 12 minutes ago, we have reached primetime radio. So I know there's enough people listening now that, given the right incentive, if you all haven't been all pitched out from all the other fundraising and shows in WBAI, you can get one of these. One person is calling. You see, I knew it would happen. Let's get 4 more calls and they'll all be gone. And we can actually do other things this morning. Listen more to Richard Kadrey and some Samhain music and Halloween stuff like that. 212-209-2950. Is the number to call to become a member of WBAI and to show your support for this radio program, Hour of the Wolf, and the idea of having a regular speculative fiction, fantasy, science fiction, horror program, which has been on these airwaves for so many years, and you want to keep it here, don't you? Well, I certainly do, but over the years we've learned that lots of people do. So be one of those people. There's a second call. Very good. Just three more, and we're done. 212-209-2950. There are only five copies. More are not going to appear, and if they do, they're not going to be autographed by Richard Kadrey, you know, through these means, and it won't be for WBAI. All the books were donated. We didn't buy them or anything. The publisher gave them to us, and Richard signed them during this interview. The publisher had gotten them to me so that during this, and they went straight to the premium office, which also means, by the way, this premium should be fulfilled rather quickly. If it is not for any reason, and Lord knows it's WBAI, just, you know, send me an email, call me, and I'll do what it takes to make sure it's fulfilled. A third call is coming in. Thank you very much. Please be patient, because we only have two people back there. I'm sure that Ken Gale and Max Schmid are going to go back and help take the next two calls. Two more calls, we're done. That's it, just two more calls. 212-209-2950. Let's make it easy, and it has been going easily. We have only five copies, autographed copies, of Kill the Dead by Richard Kadrey, and I suspect right now three of them are being taken. Two more calls, and all five will be gone. 212-209-2950. That is my interim goal for now. We can talk more later, but for now, I just want to move these premiums, which Richard and his publisher have been so good in getting to us. Two more calls, 212-209-2950. In only 3 minutes, we've gotten three calls. Let's get the other two now. And as pointed out, these are actual collector's items. I made a joke, and he said, to whom should I make this out? And I said, eBay. Well, yeah, you know, it's not completely. And we actually had a debate. Should we write in there, thank you for subscribing to WBAI? Or should we do it, much thanks, Richard Kadrey or whatever. I actually don't remember what. I think we decided the latter, so that these would be collector's items, because if people want to give WBAI the gift of $75, then they're willing to go the next. Okay, there's the fourth call. One more call, and these will be gone. Okay, just one more call, one copy left, I presume. I'm not getting feedback from the tally room because, well, they're busy. Okay, but I have seen four calls come in. We're now down to two, so that means one more call, one book left, and then this opportunity is gone. 212-209-2950. Your donation to WBAI for $75 goes to keep listener-sponsored radio broadcasting. It goes to show this listener-sponsored radio station that this show is something that you value, and you'll get yourself, by way of thanks, an autographed copy of Kill the Dead by Richard Kadrey. And it's a fun book, I really have to say. Sandman Slim is out in paperback, but this is hardcover. It just came out, so it's very timely as far as that is concerned. And it's a fun read, which you can't say about a lot of horror books. And it's really not gruesome. Read it and you'll see. And we'll keep listening to the interview, and we should be able to hear the fiction that Richard recorded for us and sent to us, because the pledges are coming in. But we need the call now. We need that one more call, one more pledge of $75. And this segment is over, and we go straight back to the interview. 212-209-2950. Make that call now. Make that pledge now. And we're back to our Halloween programming. 212-209-2950. One call, please. I don't want to be talking. You don't want to be hearing this. You want to be listening to Richard Kadrey talk about his work. And then read. And that's actually what's in limbo here. If we don't get to... if we take too much time pitching, there won't be time for the reading. Is that a fifth call? Is that the call? 212-209-2950. That might be the call. And let's see, it hasn't been answered yet. Please be patient. There's only two people there, and they're trying to handle five calls and do the paperwork and all that good stuff. But if somebody could just pick up that phone, take it off the hook so that I know, that's it. Ooh, okay. One call went away. Another call came in. Now only one person is talking. There are two people talking. If that one sticks, if that one stays and doesn't get hung up on after just a few moments, that means it's a real call. And I'm going to presume that each one of those people are taking a copy of this book because it is a unique opportunity. Okay, it seems to be real. So I'm going to go back and find out if it is real. And if, by the way, you'd just like to make a donation to WBAI, well, you won't find us turning it down. And you can do that by calling 212-209-2950. $25 makes you a member of WBAI, an important thing to be, and showing support for Hour of the Wolf. Much appreciated, may I add. Okay, so we're, let's see, where are we? We're at about 39 minutes into a 50-minute interview. We have 11 more minutes of interview and then reading. And then there's another segment of the interview. I don't think we're going to get to that this morning. But, and there will be another block of time and we that we will do that. And we actually have that reading from the New York Review of Science Fiction from 15 years ago that Claire Wolf, now Claire Wolf Smith, produced. We have two readings that Richard did for us and two portions of interview, and we will broadcast all of those in one place or put together a gift DVD or something like that. But I believe all copies have been taken. I'm going to go back and find out, and you can now hear the rest of the interview with Richard Kadrey.
They're the ones who are right. Even if you're criticizing it, even if you're going, well, the Catholics were awful for this, or the Kabbalists, you know, were too obscure. You know, I throw the Gnostics in there, too. It's like, is this, are these, mystery religions worth anything, or are they purely, you know, exclusive and exclusionary? You know, what's the value of them? But wanting to throw all that into the mix to get across the idea that no one's right. And that no one's wrong, though, that everybody has a piece of the puzzle, but that that no particular side has the answer. Mm-hmm. And that's why there are all those little bits throughout. And it's been interesting getting reactions of people, because some people recognize this part of the myths, and some people, you know, recognize this. I've actually had some nice discussions, especially with the Kabbalistic stuff. The few people who've caught that stuff have always had the most interesting things to say.
And usually most Kabbalists, you know, they're not purely that.
They
come to the Kabbalah because they're studying a lot of things, not just Kabbalah.
You know, as a Protestant growing up in Brooklyn and then in Texas, the people I talked to about interesting ideas was always the rabbis, because they were the ones. The whole tradition is to think, to argue, to question everything.
Rabbis, and Jesuits.
I didn't know the Jesuits till I was older.
Yeah.
But the thinking traditions, and then being drawn into the Protestant tradition later, that was purely shut up. This is the doctrine. to even ask hard questions was in itself sinful. Mm-hmm. To ask, you know, well, what's this thing in the book of Genesis about Lot trying to protect the angels come to Lot in Sodom and tell him to leave because Sodom's going to be destroyed. And Sodom lets the angels into his house to keep, you know, as a good host. And then the crowd shows up that wants him to give them the angels, and Lot's response is, oh, take my virgin daughters instead.
Right.
To ask the question of, like, how is that okay for him to throw his virgin daughters to this mob to save the angels?
Mm-hmm.
To which the reply, usually in the tradition I grew up in, was, shut up.
Yeah, well,
this is the word. Welcome. This is the inspired word from God. Nobody made mistakes. Every single word of this is true. even the depictions of the crucifixion, which is so contradictory when you read the different depictions, you know, even those don't ask the questions,
mm-hmm.
which just is so insulting to anybody who has a brain. You know, it's almost, the argument always was, well, if you have faith, you won't ask those questions. That this is
yeah, that's
your own test. Like, can you have faith by being dumb? And no.
Blind faith.
I couldn't.
Blind faith. Yeah.
Which,
blind, deaf, and dumb faith, really.
Yeah, which, you know, I, at some point, we got thrown out because basically I couldn't have it. It just struck me as dumb and sinful in itself to be dumb.
Yeah.
Struck me as, if you're going to believe this stuff, sinful. Years ago, during when cloning, when the first sheep was cloned, Dolly the sheep, I wrote for Wired magazine a lot, and they were sending me around to talk to certain people about cloning. And there was a doctor named Richard Seed who was actually, he was famous in scientific circles, not major popular ones. But he was one of the people who worked on, for instance, the first birth control pill a million years ago. So he was a very serious scientist.
Oh, he must be a favorite of some religious figures.
Well, yeah. that break between science and religion. But I interviewed him at his home years ago, and this is a guy who's a very pure scientist, lives in his head, is very pure about this. And yet, when this guy started talking about the gift of intelligence from God, this is a grown man who started tearing up because his faith was God gave us brains, and that the thing we were put on earth to do was to think and to advance and to push the edges of humanity, which again is completely contradictory to the stuff I grew up with, that there is this pure separation of, you know, science is not faith. You know, to sort of put that together, to try and understand the universe even, was in fact sinful, because if you try to understand the universe, you're trying to be God.
Yeah, and my understanding has always been science is faith. Explain dark matter to me.
That's who this guy was. And to see this, you know, old man who was could talk at length about science and then tear up about his relationship to religion and to God, that was a really interesting moment
Einstein
to see.
Einstein was another, of course. He was a very religious man in his own way.
Right.
And that religion, of course, involved science. And when he actually would come across theories that countered his ways of thinking, he had anger when he said something like, God does not play dice with the universe. He says it with all seriousness.
Oh, yeah.
About chaos theory.
Quantum mechanics, things like that. That was that was a test for him.
Yeah, wasn't it, though? Wasn't it, though? Well, at this point, we should probably take a break and allow you a moment, and then perhaps you shall read for us.
Sounds good.
Very good.
The other thing, I mean, we're having this religious discussion here. I also want to point out that, like the Narnia stuff, you don't need to know any of this stuff to read the Sandman Slim books, because the Sandman Slim books are in themselves a 70s action movie. They're about people punching each other, getting punched, shooting each other, stealing cars, drinking and smoking too much. All this religious stuff we're talking about is completely unnecessary to understand this stuff.
And it's, by the way, not in the horror tradition of let's describe dismemberment as much as we can.
Exactly.
I have a weak stomach.
Right.
I don't care for dismemberment, gross out fiction. I had no trouble with Sandman Slim and Kill the Dead.
Yeah, there's a little more dismemberment in Kill the Dead because I wanted to invent my own zombie mythology. I didn't want to do the George Romero shoot him in the head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea in mine was that you have to destroy the central nervous system by pulling out their spines.
Yes.
That was important. It's a little more gory, but I don't want to get into, you know, what the viscera looks like.
Exactly, exactly.
Glowing in the moonlight.
Yeah, exactly. That, which is really what I was getting at. I don't mind when things happen. I do mind when that's the only point.
Right, right.
If it's a means to an end, okay. But when it is the end, for me, it's the end as well.
And that, for me, was really funny. The idea of, like, well, you, it's not this clean George Romero thing of shooting him in the head. You have to do this horrible, very physically difficult thing to actually kill a zombie. It's really, really hard to kill zombies.
Yeah, the whole, yes, I was thinking Rasputin there, and the mythology.
Yes, exactly.
The killing of Rasputin.
Yeah, you got to do it seven times to get it right.
Exactly. Well, and that is a point. It's, this isn't comedy in the sense that, like, movies Hostel or Saw are considered comedies because, oh my God, you know, there's like this political metaphor when they're boring the drill into that person's eye. No,
I actually would argue about the political subtext of Hostel. I actually think there's one moment in that movie that reveals politics that made me love it.
Oh, I absolutely have. I will take people's word that there is legitimate text, subtext in Hostel, and even perhaps in Saw. I hope everybody at home sees it. We're shaking, wiggling our hands, going, maybe. But Hostel, certainly. I mean, the author, director of that, the auteur of that work, absolutely was trying to do it. It is still, nevertheless, something I will unfortunately never see because.
Well, if you have a problem with complete abuse of physical bodies, yes.
Exactly.
It's a hard movie.
So Hostel, I can see, yes, they are doing that for that reason, and it's too bad it won't be a film for me. But I wanted to say that these books are comedy in a totally different manner. One can certainly see the movie Yojimbo as a comedy.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, if you want to get highbrow about it. And we're talking about Westerns and 70s stories with, what was the American version of Yojimbo with Eastwood?
The good to bad. The previous one. Fistful of Dollars.
That's
the first one.
Fistful of Dollars. That's the one. Yeah,
absolutely. Leone, huge influence on me. You know, I can't talk about how
Leone and
much
Kurosawa
of an impact.
Writing these love letters to each other.
Yeah,
and
which made perfect sense. And John Ford too in there too with him and Kurosawa.
Yeah, except that he was working years earlier.
He influenced them both.
But Leone was watching Kurosawa. Kurosawa was watching Leone. And the two of them are having
a cinematic dialogue. Exactly.
And I see the Sandman Slim in part of that great dialogue.
Definitely trying. Yes, very, very consciously.
Yeah, and I guess that was the point I was trying to make, however
we got
poorly.
There. Took a while, we got there.
Okay, and at this point, I think we should take a break, and then we will be back with Richard Kadrey, who will be reading for us.
Okay, and this is WBAI in New York City, Non-Commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. And we were 80% successful in moving the five books. There is indeed one book left. 212-209-2950. A $75 donation will get you an autographed copy of the book we were talking about there, Kill the Dead by Richard Kadrey. And as mentioned, it is indeed a collector's item to get that. And I would like to thank the four people who donated $75 each to get a copy. And one of them, at least, is a good friend. Haven't heard from in a little while. He should write me or call me at home. Anyway, because it's been a while since I've seen him. But I don't know that I have permission to mention anybody's name on the air. So I'll just, two people from Brooklyn called, but one was in Canada. and one is in New York. But we need your call now. We need one more pledge. Oh, and somebody, by the way, donated $10, and we're very, very grateful for that. And by the way, if you can only donate $10, consider calling. You can call up and ask about what it means to be a WBAI buddy. It's like giving $10 a month or something like that, which, of course, turns out to be a nice amount of money for us overall. Obviously more. But right now, if you'd like to give $75, you can get an autographed copy of Kill the Dead by Richard Kadrey. I thought there were five gone, but in fact, one was just a straight donation, and I'm very grateful for that as well. But I want to move this last book, one collector's item left. Let's get them all into the mail real soon. And I'm saying that to everybody involved, by the way. 212-209-2950. One copy left. Let's get that going. And then Richard will read for you. And in fact, he read for us in the studio. But at the time, off the air, he said, you know what? There's a story that I would rather read that I think would fit this show much better. And he went home to San Francisco. He recorded it and he mailed it to me. Earlier this week, one call is coming in. Is that the one? Cookie, please let me know. Just like wave your hand over the monitor or something like that to let me know it's been taken so that we can move on to the reading and to the rest of the show. So please, as soon as that is gone, just indicate to me that the last book is gone. 212-209-2950, in case that is not the case. They will tell you if there is one book left or not. And also, you can still donate to WBAI or buy copies for Making Waves or become a WBAI buddy. Buddy is such a neat word, isn't it? Okay, so Richard went home, recorded a short story, and has emailed it. It's excellent professional sound quality. And so I'm going to play that alternate one, the one that he recorded in San Francisco for us. But we're going to have the time to play it. And we're only going to have that if enough calls have come in. That could be there. Okay, the call has gone away. And I hope to see on the monitor whether or not that was the last copy of the book, or else somebody can come in to let me know. Because as soon as I know that that last copy has gone, then I can move on to the rest of the show. But in the meantime, you can still call and pledge. 212-209-2950. WBAI has become such an essential part, and we have been struggling so hard to get the support. Oh, here comes Cookie now. To get the support that we need, because time's thin out. And here she is. Hi there. No, we still have one. We still have one, she nods. So there's still time for you to call, 212-209-2950. And can I mention this name on the air? I can. Thank you, Gary. Gary Tesser. I said there was a friend of mine in Brooklyn who I haven't seen in a number of years, and that was he. Thank you, Plucky Red Ace. A shout out to the Plucky Red Ace. But we still need a pledge. We still need one more of these copies gone. 209-2950. It is 6:37 in the morning. The reading that Richard did for us. Let's see exactly how long does that last. Let me close this here. Find the file that he sent me. Flayed Ed is the name of the story. It is 5 minutes and 44 seconds, okay? It's a nice short story. And then we have some music and some Samhain stuff and some announcements also. One more call coming in. 212-209-2950. Make sure that's the one. Let's see if it is sticky. That is to say, if it actually stays on the line. Then I'll know it's a real pledge. And what I'll do is, if it stays on long enough, I'll say, okay, that's it, and I'll play the short story. I'm not going to hold it hostage. But what will happen is, if it is not for the book, If it is not for the book, then when, after the short story, I'm going to have to pitch more. If it is for the book, we'll move on with the rest of the show. That's how it goes. So, that call is sticky. It is staying. It is a real call, a real pledge. Don't know if it's for the book or not. Ooh, we're up to 385. Thank you. Being lovely if we made 500 this morning, wouldn't it? 212-209-2950. And here now is the reading that Richard recorded for us in San Francisco.
Flayed Ed by Richard Cadry. Plainfield, Wisconsin, November 1957. The body of Bernice Warden was found strung up and gutted like a deer carcass in Ed Gein's barn. Ed was quickly arrested, declared insane, and sent to Wisconsin's Central State Hospital, where he'd spend the rest of his life. By 1959, the people of Plainfield and the sheriff's department in particular, who'd been first on the scene at Ed's farm, had more or less gone back to their old lives. Farming, teaching, investigating occasional traffic accidents, and arresting weekend brawlers. By 1960, no one in Plainfield talked about Ed's crimes, and only the youngest and greenest recruits in the sheriff's department were dumb enough to ask about them. The weeks of counting scalps, putting human bones into evidence bags, and documenting the skin suit Ed had made from female corpses were long behind them, and they'd work hard to put Ed's crimes out of their minds. There had never been many murders in Plainfield, and since Ed had gone off to the loony bin, not a single cannibal psychopath. By 1961, Ed's memory had dulled to occasional Halloween water cooler jokes. But Ed's presence never entirely disappeared from the community, and he continued to haunt Plainfield right through the end of the millennium. Then the flies came. Then the rains of blood. Then all of Plainfield's children went blind in a single night. Deep in the eastern sky, the source of light, fertility, and life, Xipe Totec, Aztec warrior, the god of suffering, the lord of spring, the ruler of the east, often called the blood-red mirror by his followers, stirred from his sleep. He became an eagle and rode the winds looking for his offerings and sacrifices, but he found none. Starving and enraged, Xipe Totec frowned, and blood and disease fell from the heavens. Back in 1978, Ed had been relocated to the Mendota Mental Health Institute in Madison, Wisconsin. He died there in 1984, after working for 5 years as the barber in the segregated male wing of the hospital. None of the staff saw any problem with giving Ed access to razors and scissors. After all, Ed had never killed or even hurt a man. Ed's interests were exclusively on women. What no one in the hospital, especially the doctors, understood was why. What the doctors called schizophrenia, accompanied by psychosexual dementia, Ed called God. He knew the shape of the sacrifices the old forgotten deities found acceptable, the blood they demanded. The skin dances they craved were fed through the flesh of wise women, not foolish men. What tormented Ed more than being arrested, more than being locked up for decades, was that he hadn't finished his flayed sacrifices or properly done the offering dance. During his first years at the hospital, Ed was afraid. Eventually, he understood that he'd be long dead before the gods awakened and noticed the absence of their sustenance. In the spring of 1984, when the cicadas chirped and mayflies appeared in swarms, Ed collapsed and was taken to the infirmary for the last time. He was thrilled. He knew that death was finally coming for him. Xipe Totec, our Lord of the Flayed One, is represented to mortals by a mask found in many Aztec archaeological digs. He's depicted as a man's face with blank eyes and what appears to be a mouth inside a larger, toothless mouth. In reality, the smallest mouth is that of the Aztec priest, who wears the human skin of a sacrifice, bloody side out. Blood and flesh are Xipe Totec's nourishment. The dance in the flayed skin is the platter on which Xipe Totec's meals are served. But being good, God-fearing Christians, none of the residents of Plainfield, Wisconsin knew any of this. Around the millennium, When the blood rains first fell, Plainfield suffered terribly as they prayed and fervently and sincerely to the wrong god. Their cattle convulsed and died in the fields. Ranchers and dairymen thought their herds had contracted mad cow disease. Hazmat-suited men from the Center for Disease Control slaughtered and burned the cattle in the fields. Still, the CDC couldn't tell the farmers why their apples bled like gutted warriors when they picked them, or why the kernels inside their corn crops were the rotten teeth of the dead. News crews from around the world invaded Plainfield's sad, wet streets. The Army Corps of Engineers built levees to hold back the swollen, blood-colored rivers. Eventually, the governor had to declare martial law, and the National Guard troops moved in to keep order. The soldiers soon fell ill with boils and a new Ebola-like disease that left them bleeding through their skin. And the flies never left, but spread from Plainfield out across Wisconsin, bringing disease and the awful red rains with them. In the eastern sky, Jepetotec's appetite and anger grew. He couldn't understand why, after all his warnings and punishments, the mortals wouldn't simply make the sacrifices that would end their misery. And from somewhere high above, Ed looked down on it all and laughed an old coot's laugh.
Flaying Ed. Read for you by the author, Richard Kadrey. And this is WBAI New York, the program's Hour of the Wolf, and we have been listening to an interview with Richard Kadrey. There is another segment to the interview. It is a half hour long, and what we are going to do is find another way of bringing that to you. But I want to thank the woman who called from Newark, New Jersey, who took the last copy of Kill the Dead. So indeed, we have moved them all these collector's items that we had available for you this morning. And it is much appreciated here, and much appreciated, by the way, that Richard Kadrey gave of his time and effort, and the publisher did as well. And we will call this the special Samhain preview of what will be the full Richard Kadrey broadcast. And actually, I've got quite a bit of cool stuff. There's another half hour to that interview, plus there's a 45-minute reading that he did in 1996 for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And I have that on hand. So, and another reading that he did while here at WBAI earlier this month. So we've got all kinds of material for you. And if you're into, you know, light, which that wasn't, by the way, light comedy horror, then some of those will appeal. But, you know, he has a whole range of stuff. You know, Metrophage being considered a classic in You see, the word steampunk keeps getting stuck. Cyberpunk is what it is, not steampunk. I saw somebody on Twitter say steampunk is what happened when goths discovered brown. I thought that was a very good summary of something that has become, so ubiquitous. Okay, so it has indeed worked out. In order to play the outro that I want to play for the show, well, it's a 7-minute outro, but it's one of the must plays for Samhain. And before we do that, time for some announcements. This Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, last Tuesday, we had a special meeting of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. That was Beyond Blackula. We'll be broadcasting that at some point after I edit it. I'm getting the photographs up now. It was a good event. And we're going to have another good event this coming Tuesday after all these people are tuckered out from having attended a World Fantasy Convention in Ohio this year. We're going to just haul them back for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. I know at least two out of the three are attending World Fantasy this year. And that is to say Neil Clark and Genevieve. And, well, Neil Clark puts out a monthly science fiction and fantasy magazine and has been since 2006. And it's called Clark's World. When I first saw that name, I assumed it was Arthur C. No, it's Neil Clark out of Jersey. And he puts out chapbooks and things like that. But it's primarily a website of fiction. Is it quality? Well, it won this year's Hugo Award for Best Semi-Prozine. And semi-prozines are actually very, very cool. Sometimes a lot better than a lot of prozines. It's oh, that sounds like a drug, doesn't it? Have you taken your semi-prozine?
Might cause loss of hair.
Yes, exactly. And here's a drug that needs to be taken every month when every issue comes out. And in a couple of days, the 50th issue is about to come out. And to celebrate that, plus the Hugo Award, plus he's up for a World Fantasy Award this very weekend. In fact, we'll know tonight whether or not he won it. Well, we're going to celebrate that magazine. He is going to... and the name of the event is... I have to take a couple of deep breaths before I can say the name of the event. Clark's World, 50th Anniversary, and oh my God, did we really win the Hugo Award? Election Day Celebration for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art.
That sounds familiar.
That's just the title. That's just the title. The devil's in the details. And the devils, in this case, they're not devils. They're wonderful people. Genevieve Valentine, who's been on this show several times, and Deserina Boscovich, who I was saying, oh, that's a new name. I don't really know her at all. That's going to be very cool. And then I saw, when I was looking up her Twitter name, I realized, oh, I've been following her for a year. In fact, I've read her stuff. I just didn't recognize her Twitter name was Cracking Des. So I didn't immediately go, oh, yeah, of course, Deserina Boscovich. But that's who we've got for you. Deserina Boscovich and Genevieve Valentine as part of the Clark's World celebration this coming Tuesday at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And, Jim, you really ought to have memorized the address, but I'm doing so many different things this morning. Let me just, Soho Gallery. Oh, and look, it came right up in the search engine, the Soho Gallery for Digital Art at, is it 138 or, yes, it's 138 Sullivan Street. You see, I might have said 238 or something. It's 138 Sullivan Street. It's Sullivan Street between Prince and Houston. And the doors open at 6:30. The event starts at 7. Admission is free, although donations are muchly appreciated. So, I'm on such automatic that I was almost going to be giving the phone number after that. Oh, and by the way, the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, which earlier this month did a bacon festival that was actually covered on All Things Considered. It was Margot, okay? It was Margot. Let's get down to it. It was Adler. But tonight they're doing a simulcast of the Rally to Restore Sanity. So you can actually be there with people to watch this whole event live, the whole thing beginning to end. And that should be a lot of fun. And to find out more about that, you'd go to the Soho Gallery for Digital Arts website. But we'd like to see you there on Tuesday for my event. And that would be lovely. Do say hello afterward. Okay, so my outro this morning is 7 minutes long. And I am going to start it in time to play the whole thing. So there's, of course, lots of people to thank. Including Max Schmid, who made it possible. There was a technical screw-up, so, thank you, Max. Thank you, Cookie. Thank you, the people who answer the phones. Thank you, the people who called and pledged.
Thank WBAI for existing in the first place so that the show can exist. Oh, you know what I need to do? I need to simply copy that song. Yeah, hold on one moment, gang. We don't want to run over here now, do we? Here we go. There's the there's the song. There was a time when I wanted to play nothing but this song and many variations of it in October. Well, this will be one of them. So, this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Visit the website, HOURWOLF.com. And we'll be back next week with actually themes similar to this, with a couple of professors. One of Simon's favorite professors will be the guest next week. That's Professor Shanus.
I look forward to that.
And she is a lovely professor. Well, tune in then. And thank you for listening. Good morning and happy Samhain.
I forbid you maidens all that wear gold in your hair to travel to Carter Hall.
Tuned to WBAI New York City. That's 99.5 on your FM dial. Land sakes alive, and good morning, and hello, and welcome to As I Please for this, the 30th day of October in the year 10. Today, the birthday of the second president of the United States, a Mr. John Adams. Today, the birthday of that great jazz trumpeter, Clifford Brown. But today is also the 125th anniversary of the birth of Ezra Pound, which will be the subject for this morning. And before I go any further, let me remind you that, yes, fundraising will be part of the process this morning. So allow me now to give you the phone number, because I really don't want to be reciting it a whole lot this morning. So I'll tell you now, and who knows, but you might be inspired in the course of this morning to donate $125 to WBAI, a dollar for every year of Ezra Pound's enduring memory. 125 years ago today, in the small town of Haley, Idaho, Pound arrived and said, "Grabbera!" 212-209-2950. And I want to thank so many for showing up at Stand Up Academy for a show for Ez this past Monday. And if indeed you were one of the happy few, this morning's program will be familiar. But I am of the opinion, and I certainly hope I am right, I am of the opinion that a second time will be a benefit for all of us, while those of you tuning in now for the very first time, you are in for a treat, we hope. And yet another thing I'll say before I go any further, and that is, once again, that if you are not interested in poetry, then the career of Ezra Pound is of no matter to you. Indeed, for those who have written hearty letters of protest because of Ezra Pound's wartime activities, I hasten to point out that it might be of greater value if you concentrated on fascists living today than worrying about the rather puzzling career of Ezra Pound. After all, the fascist, the Nazi, the tyrant is not an endangered species. On the other hand, if you are interested in poetry, then sooner or later you are going to have to deal with Ezra Pound, and over the past few weeks I have suggested some places where you might begin, as with his translations, or with those poems written before he set to work on the cantos. All this, more or less, this morning on As I Please. Welcome aboard. The Ezra Pound 125th birthday program is now in the air. Again, good morning and welcome to As I Please for yet another show for Ez. And I do appreciate the gamble that management took on allowing this program, this series, to continue through the month of October, though indeed the rest of the station dedicated to fundraising. I dedicated myself to both fundraising and celebrating the work of a remarkable poet, who accomplished a great deal. In terms of poetry, that's all we are concerned about this morning. And as seems, alas, necessary, I will begin this morning with a few remarks to prepare your listening, to prepare you for your listening experience, bearing in mind that ideally you will now or later today run out and buy yourself a complete edition of the works of Ezra Pound. It'll set you back a bit, but you will also, in the course of that, also make a donation to WBAI, because today is the day. And there might be a 3-minute squib on NPR, or, you know, I doubt if CBS is going to cover it. I doubt a lot of things are going to cover it. But you're getting it here at WBAI. And frankly, we could all use a little more poetry in our systems. However, before I begin giving you the commentary, I thought I'd give you a little bit of toe-tap and music to sort of prepare you for this. I'll remind you of the phone number again, 212-209-2950. And I have brought in this morning a tune featuring a performance by the great Lester Young. And there are two reasons why I have brought in Lester Young this morning as my assistant and as a guest star. One, and I think this is an important one, the Prez was also a guest of the United States Army during the closing months of the Second World War. Why they went out of their way to draft Lester Young is beyond me. And it is clear that he was just not set up that way. This was just not the sort of thing he was. He just wasn't made up for it. And consequently, after many, many violations and so on, they threw him in the slammer. So there is that reason to pair Pound and Prez. But then, of course, the title alone seems fitting for an Ezra Pound birthday celebration. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you now the Count Basie Orchestra, featuring the great Lester Young on tenor saxophone, with a rollicking little tune called Pound Cake. Thank you.